There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. It's media freedom and our right to communicate. I'm Paul Rees-Mandel, and I'm your host. On today's program, we finally have a full FCC. NPR's got a brand new website, and the Senate's going to take a look at more royalties payments for radio. It's a big news update. You do want to stay tuned. Well, last week on the radio show, Matthew Lassar joined me, and we were talking about the new FCC, which has now a total of three new commissioners out of a total of five. New chairman, Julius Genachowski, joined by now two new members. On July 24th, the Senate finally confirmed the last two commissioners needed to fill out the Federal Communications Commission. By unanimous consent, the Senate approved Democrat Mignon Clyburn and Republican Meredith Atwell Baker, making this the first time the FCC has had all five seats filled since 2008. Baker is the former acting head of the National Telecommunications and Information Administration. Clyburn is a South Carolina utility regulator and daughter of House Majority Whip James Clyburn, a Democrat from South Carolina. Baker is fulfilling the unexpired term of former FCC Chairman Kevin Martin, which runs through June 30th, 2011. Clyburn gets a full 5 years, taking a seat vacated by Deborah Taylor Tate, whose term expired in January. During her July 15th confirmation hearing, Mignon Clyburn voiced support for affordable broadband and internet openness, along with concern about media consolidation. Meredith Atwell Baker also stressed the importance of broadband, and surprisingly for Republican, shared Clyburn's concern over additional media consolidation. However, while Baker expressed support for an open internet, she also said she does not support full network neutrality, citing the need of operators to police their networks for illegal or pirated content. In the same Senate vote, former Democratic FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein was confirmed to join the Department of Agriculture's Rural Utility Service. Adelstein is expected to head up the deployment of the department's $2.5 billion share of federal stimulus monies allocated for rural broadband development. And Adelstein will be missed on the FCC by media reformers and people who were really looking for the public interest to be expressed. He had been a longtime supporter of network neutrality and a critic of media consolidation, and did not share the same Jones for indecency enforcement that his fellow Democratic Commission Michael Copps had. So right now, though, people are trying to figure out, well, what is this new full FCC going to do? A lot of issues that the commission has been considering over the last 6 months or more have been put on the back burner because there's only been a total of three commissioners, which is enough to make a decision, but hard to make one that really is valid or holds water for very long, since it looks like it would be a loaded decision. So I really want a full commission in order to seem as though the process is happening in a more democratic fashion. One thing that seems to be in front of the FCC is some reform of the commission, something which has been called for by both Democrats and Republicans. A lot of criticism of the FCC was made during the Bush administration. Former chairman Michael Powell came in for a lot of criticism for the way in which he handled the commission's review of media ownership rules. This went down in the early part of the Bush administration from 2000 to 2003. The commission is actually required to review its media ownership rules biannually as part of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. And by most accounts, Chairman Powell did his best to kind of ram through rule changes, greatly hoping to loosen media ownership rules and create even more consolidated media. His critics wanted him to hold public hearings, which he resisted until finally relenting and holding just one in Virginia, so not far from D.C. And in a lot of ways, I think it's arguable that Chairman Powell's mishandling of that really provided the catalyst for the media reform movement as we know it now. I mean, media consolidation is brought on by the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and especially the rise of Clear Channel and similar media behemoths also did a lot. But really, the apparently undemocratic approach of Chairman Powell helped to really bring together public interest advocates, progressive scholars, legal scholars, as well as many people in Congress, congresspeople and other political folks to think about media reform in a big way. Former Chairman Martin, who served under the second Bush administration, or second half of the Bush administration, was at a lighter hand than Powell in a lot of ways. And he did read the writing on the wall and hold many more public hearings on media ownership as the FCC had to reconsider the rules, which were struck down by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. At the same time, he nevertheless came in for a lot of criticism from his own fellow commissioners because of the way in which he still would ham-handedly ram through particular items very close to him on a number of different issues, including the FCC's take on the co-ownership of television stations and newspapers, wherein the particular ruling was basically put underneath the noses of his fellow commissioners with barely even 24 hours advance notice prior to their being expected to vote on it. And that particular piece of rulemaking is now also facing a court challenge again and may never take effect, depending on what the current FCC decides to do with it. Chairman Martin was also accused of being parsimonious with data and often only presenting data which supported the rules that he wanted to see created. So it's with that background that reform of the FCC has come about. And of course, you have many free marketeers, so-called free marketeers, libertarians, Republicans, who have been calling for the utter demise of the FCC, not happy about having any sort of regulation of the media sphere at all, or especially or any area that the FCC happens to watch over at all. So with that, a couple of weeks ago, the commission started an internal website called reboot.fcc.gov, where right now it's open to employees to make suggestions for reform. Chairman Jenikowski said eventually the site will become public, where the public will be able to interact and also make its suggestions for reform. And one of the chief motivators on this so-called reform movement within the FCC is actually Republican Commissioner Robert McDowell, who has been serving since the Bush administration, who renewed his call for a comprehensive financial and ethics audit of the FCC and related entities, including the Universal Service Fund. The Universal Service Fund are monies collected as a tax on phone bills, which go to make sure that phone service is available to all people to help subsidize phone service, especially for low-income folks. But besides this reform, there is a ton of other things sitting in front of the FCC that require some degree of action. One of the things is there is a question of priority between low-power FM stations. These are non-commercial community stations or low-power and inexpensive. that have been rolled out since 2000. What is the priority between them and FM translator stations, which are repeater stations for full power signals? And the question is really if a repeater station is infringing on a low power FM station, does a low power FM station take priority? There is some resolution that has to be found over white spaces. This is some of the spectrum that has been freed up or was basically unused, but freed up when the digital television switch. And they need to decide about making this spectrum available for use by wireless devices, perhaps in an unlicensed form. And there are appeals from the television industry pending on that. And there is actually some proposals in front of the commission to take channels 5 and 6, TV channels 5 and 6, and turn them into radio channels, since they abut the FM dial at the lower end. Channel 6 actually shows up at 87.7 FM as an audio carrier. There have been some proposals to allow AM stations to be able to move over into that space. There have been some proposals to make this space available specifically to minority broadcasters. And we've mentioned here on the show, and I've blogged about it at radiosurvivor.com, how there's a few television stations operating on Channel 6 that are legacy low-power analog TV stations that are using Channel 6 to broadcast radio programming. They still have a TV signal showing slideshows and such. One of them is here in Chicago playing Smooth Jazz, which came on the air at 87.7 FM after the demise of WNUA, which is a long-running Smooth Jazz commercial station here in Chicago. As well, the commercial radio industry would like to see the FCC authorize increasing digital HD radio power. But there is a lot of worry that increasing the power of the digital signal would create interference. Already, people complain about digital radio interfering, because what it basically does is squeeze in a digital signal on the side. And if you can imagine looking at an analog radio dial and how there's space for every station on the side of regular old analog station. So there's all sorts of things there. And still there has been this ongoing proceeding on localism, on media localism, the FCC seeing that as a concern. It's something which, when it came up at the FCC, it was something brought up by Chairman Michael Powell, and a lot of folks thought it as a red herring, is a way to try and avoid dealing with the media consolidation issue, or a way of making the issues that people have with the way their local media, whether radio or television, serves a local community, a separate issue, apart and different from ownership. But that proceeding is still going on, and there have been some regulations proposed, including a return to requiring that the main studios of a station actually reside in the city it's licensed to. In any major metroplex, it's likely you can look through various stations which appear to be licensed to smaller communities, licensed often to what are called rim shots or surrounding communities to a metroplex, but they'll put their studios in the major city, even though the license is to a smaller city on the fringe. There's a possibility that that could be reversed. There's also some proposals to increase diversity in broadcast ownership, especially with regard to minority ownership, and things over commercials. And, of course, still sitting in front of the courts is the challenge to the FCC's indecency ruling over fleeting expletives. As we mentioned here on the air a number of months ago, the Supreme Court ruled that, indeed, it was not patently unconstitutional for the FCC to have changed course and decide that fleeting expletives are finable, but did remand that back to the lower courts to make further determinations. The FCC could determine to just give it up, and that is something which would be in front of Julius Genachowski. For his part, the new chairman has said that he expects his FCC to be boring, meaning he doesn't expect to kick up a lot of dust like the former chairman Martin. It does seem as though broadband innovation and having good broadband service and deployment is very high on his list. So we'll continue to keep track of it here. And why we look at the FCC on MediaGeek is because this is the commission which is making so many of the rules which affect the communications we receive on radio, on television, and telephones, and cellular phones, which many of us are now receiving much more communications over, in addition to our ability to communicate ourselves and to share information, whether it's on the internet or in broadcast, whether we're getting true local service from our broadcast outlets. We try to spin it from this way because it's the kind of news which doesn't really show up on the front page of the newspaper. It's really a political issue and almost never shows up in the politics section or the national section. It shows up in the business pages because it gets framed as a business story that what happens at the FCC is primarily of interest or what it would do to the stock of CBS or what it would do to the, well, the non-stock, the penny stock, the fortunes of Clear Channel and to investors rather than how it would affect our democracy. Eric Yurnell, producing tonight there at the controls. Thank you again for being here tonight, Eric.
Thank you, Paul.
Well, and here's a story that we've been covering for the last few months. It's the Performance Rights Act, where the coalition of the recording artists and the recording industry, the Future Music Coalition, which is more of an independent artist advocacy group, have been pushing to remove the current protection radio experiences and enjoys from having to pay royalties on the recordings they air. Satellite radio, online radio, podcasters, jukeboxes even, all have to pay royalties back to the people who own the actual recording rights. Radio has always had to pay royalties to the songwriters, as represented by such organizations as ASCAP and BMI, but has been exempt by law from having to pay for the rights to the recordings. And the justification, ostensibly, has been because radio has been looked at as a promotional vehicle for new music and has served that function for recorded music for a very long time. Well, now the many recording artists and recording companies are starting to feel like that's not so true. And it's time for radio to pay up and for it to be fair. So there is the Performance Rights Act. It's been introduced into both the Senate and the House. And the Senate Judiciary Committee is set to hold a hearing on it on August 4th. Scheduled to be there and to give their testimony about it is the National Association of Broadcasters Board Chair and Commonwealth Broadcasting President CEO Steve Newberry. Also scheduled to be there is Sheila E. I don't know if you know who Sheila E. is even.
Sheila E.
Sheila E.
Sounds like a radio person.
Sheila E. is a musician and percussionist. She was associated with Prince in the mid-80s. I believe she is in Purple Rain, which, by the way, is having its 25th anniversary this year. She is in the movie Purple Rain and had several pop hits on her own, including The Glamorous Life. But it was very unusual to be both a singer-percussionist and would sing and percuss.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the only one I could think of is a Ringo Starr.
Or Phil Collins.
True, Phil Collins.
And the guy from the Romantics.
Don't know that. No. Is that a band?
Yes. Talking in Your Sleep, you've probably heard it.
I've done it, but...
Yeah, okay. You're young. Yeah, so there are other singer percussionists, but she was right up front. Anyway, she'll be speaking on behalf of the pro-royalties lobbying group, the Music First Coalition, Rounder Records owner, Marion Leighton Levy. Rounder Records is a great records record label, which focuses on blues, folk, and other American roots music. And Real Networks Executive Vice President Bob Kimball will be there, as well as Ralph Oman, an adjunct professor at George Washington University Law School. The House Judiciary Committee already approved the House version of the Performance Rights Act, but now the opposing Local Radio Freedom Act, which blocks performance royalties, has actually gained more support. The Senate version of the Local Radio Freedom Act right now has 23 co-sponsors, and offhand, I do not know how many co-sponsors the Senate version of the Performance Rights Act has.
So would that mean basically that 23 senators are in the radio's radio's corner in the Senate?
Yeah, and on the radio art side of the argument, saying the exemption should continue.
So that doesn't look good.
No, it doesn't look good, and
it doesn't look good for radio.
Oh, no, that actually probably is pretty good to have 23 co-sponsors this early on before it's even come out of committee. That's not so bad.
I must have read something else. I said something, or I saw something that said that they had 23 senators that supported them in the Senate.
Well, but co-sponsor and supporter often thrown around. That when you have 23 co-sponsors, it could mean that you also therefore have 37 who are not 37, sorry, that's really bad math. 67, they're 50, they're 100 senators.
100.
Wow. All right, I knew my brain was somewhere else. 67 senators who are on the fence.
Okay.
So
that doesn't mean that 67
A co-sponsor says, I vocally support it, and therefore, you know, in demonstrating I'm a law, will vote for it. It could have more votes when it comes up time. So the progress it has to take is it goes through the committee, which is generally assigned such matters. If the committee votes it through, then it goes potentially to the floor. When and if it goes to the floor is up to the president of the Senate, who is not nearly as powerful as the Speaker of the House.
Right, right.
So bills are more likely to go to the Senate floor once they've passed out of committee. In the House, it can often be a crapshoot. So right now, I would say 23 co-sponsors in the Senate, that's actually not too bad. So it's probably neck and neck. It'll probably be an exciting race.
Oh yeah, definitely.
To see what happens here.
Do you want to make a prediction here on the air about how this thing's going to fall?
Well, since already in the House, the Local Radio Freedom Act has more support. In fact, it does have a majority, of House members signed on to it. The Performance Royalties Act doesn't look like it's got much of a hope because you do have to pass both the Senate and the House.
Yes.
So it looks like we're going to have a lot of smoke, but not a lot of fire. That's my prediction at the moment. But I don't often call these things correctly, so I don't encourage anyone to place any money on this based upon my predictions. My analyst hat is just not that good. It's really more of a beanie with a propeller.
Oh, okay.
And when it spins left, it. I'm on this side of the table.
I would really like to see that. If next week you should bring yours in.
I should bring that in. All right. Well, so another thing I want to talk about is NPR has a new website, and it's gotten a bit of press coverage in the last week. And at npr.org, and NPR, of course, is National Public Radio, the 900-pound gorilla in public radio, which is one of the few success stories in radio in the last decade, where the likes of its commercial peers, like Clear Channel, have become penny stocks and become taken over by private equity companies. NPR, which of course is non-commercial and non-profit, has seen its audience share go up. It did enjoy a huge endowment given by the widow of Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, when she passed away. And of course, it's still seeing some tough times because of the economy, but not the kind of tough times you see in other aspects of the media. But this redesign of the NPR website is focused on making NPR.org more of a news site. So in the previous incarnation, certainly you could see news top stories, but still seemed more oriented towards giving you direction towards finding the programs you're looking for. In the new website, you definitely have a top story, much like a CNN or MSNBC or New York Times website. In this one, at this particular moment, roadside bombs make for deadly July in Afghanistan. Other top stories, Congress armed for healthcare battle during recess, new wave of political unrest, violence hits Iran, police split on what to learn from Gates' case. For some of these, there's a little speaker that says, on All Things Considered. You click that, you can go ahead and listen to that story on All Things Considered, the afternoon news magazine program. For others, there's not a direct link right there on the front page to any of the audio. And if you click through, what you do is actually you will see a transcript of the story from the airwaves, and you will also get the opportunity to be able to listen to it. And this particular story, which is interesting, and this is very new for NPR, the main story, roadside bombs make for deadly July in Afghanistan. It says that Audio from the story will be available at approximately 9 a.m. Eastern time, because the story will be on tomorrow's morning edition. And I guess they don't want to undercut people listening to it on morning edition. And yet the text version of it, already posted with a dateline of July 31st, 2009, but I'm reading this to you on July 30th, 2009, the transcript of an interview with Tom Bowman, one of the NPR correspondents, is actually published here. So this is actually taking a pretty bold step forward for NPR, which, you know, is a risky thing to some extent, because of the fact that public radio is not a centrally owned enterprise, but rather an affiliate-run enterprise. So your local NPR station is generally locally owned, or perhaps in some cases owned by a statewide consortium, and very often run by universities, sometimes run by nonprofit organizations. In some cases, there have been stations which are owned and run by local municipalities, city governments, and the like. And a big fear of theirs is that a strong national website like NPR.org might risk stealing away people, listeners, and viewers who will otherwise turn to their local stations. And of course, why that should matter is they do rely on local listeners for donations, for pledges, to stay on the air, to help fund their operations. And certainly a lot of money goes back up to the national. And in fact, that's how national NPR gets much of its funding, is via these listener donations, which eventually are funneled up. But of course, NPR is also funded nationally by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. It's also funded by underwriting, corporate underwriting, and by donations and by foundation support. So it is a bit of a step forward. But my understanding, according to many interviews that I've read with the principles behind the website, is that they're hoping to make this content easier to use by their local affiliate stations. But it is definitely a step of becoming much more online, and again, arguably more online than it had been in past, which is a refrain I guess I've been repeating time and again here on Media Geek, and I'll be here again, and how there is being so much more innovation in broadcasting coming from public radio and non-commercial radio than there has been from commercial radio. Well, that brings to a close this edition of Media Geek. I will be back in one more week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net. It's home to the Media Geek blog and the radio show. It's at radio.mediageek.net. You can download the program or subscribe to the podcast or listen right on your browser, radio.mediageek.net. And of course, the Twitter feed, twitter.com/mediageek. Check out my group blog, radiosurvivor.com, all about radio and its future. It's tough love for radio, radiosurvivor.com. And if you have any comments about this program, do them by Twitter or send me some email. Paul@MediaGeek.net. Media Geek is produced live at the studios of WNUR on the campus of Northwestern University in Evanston in Chicago, Illinois. 89.3 WNUR.org, and Media Geek got its start way back in 2002 at Community Radio WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois. Thanks for tuning in.